furniture. Standing about Cole House like a guard were several Negro youths, all dressed as he was in his characteristically neat and well-groomed manner, with a well-pressed suit, clean collar, tie, and stickpin. Younger brother recognized both the one he had followed and the one who had asked for a dime the night before. The door was closed behind him. "What is it you want?" Cole House said. Younger brother had prepared himself for this question. He had composed an impassioned statement about justice, civilization, and the right of every human being to a dignified life. He remembered none of it. "I can make bombs," he said. "I know how to blow things up." Thus did younger brother commence his career as an outlaw and revolutionary. The family was for a while spared knowledge of this. Only one thing was to link him circumstantially to the black man, and that was the disappearance from father's factory storeroom of several kegs of gunpowder and packages of dry chemicals of various kinds. The pilferage was duly reported to the police and duly forgotten by them. They were busy working on the Cole House case. Over a period of several days, younger brother transported the materials to the basement apartment in Harlem. He then went to work and concocted three powerful package bombs. He shaved his blonde mustache and he shaved his head. He blackened his face and hands with burnt cork, outlined exaggerated lips, put on a derby, and rolled his eyes. Having in this way suggested his good faith to Cole House's other young followers, by appealing to their sense of irony, he went out with them and threw the bombs into Municipal Firehouse No. 2, thereby proving himself to everyone, including himself. Our knowledge of this clandestine history comes to us by younger brother's own hand. He kept a diary from the day of his arrival in Harlem to the day of his death in Mexico a little more than a year later. Cole House Walker had militarized his mourning. His grief for Sarah and the life they might have had was hardened into a ceremony of vengeance in the manner of the ancient warrior. It was younger brother's impression that Cole House's eyes, with their peculiar gaze of unswervable intention, appeared now to be looking beyond what they saw to the grave. His command of the young men's loyalty was absolute, probably because they had not asked for it. None of them was a mercenary. There were five besides younger brother, the oldest in his 20s, the youngest not yet 18. Their respect for Cole House bordered on reverence. They lived together there in the basement of the brownstone, pooling their wages as stock clerks and delivery boys. Younger brother added several comparatively munificent pay envelopes from the flag and fireworks plant before he abandoned New Rochelle altogether. The bookkeeping of the communal treasury was scrupulous. Every penny was accounted for. They mimicked Cole House's dress, and so the suit and carefully brushed black derby was a kind of uniform. They came and went from their rooms like soldiers on patrol. At night they sat for hours and discussed their situation and what it could lead to. They studied the reactions of the press to what they had done. Cole House Walker was never harsh or autocratic. He treated his followers with courtesy and only asked if they thought something ought to be done. He dealt with them out of his constant sorrow. His controlled rage affected them like the force of a magnet. He wanted no music in the basement quarters, no instrument of any kind. They embraced every discipline. They had brought in several cots and laid out a barracks. They shared kitchen chores and house-cleaning chores. They believed they were going to die in a spectacular manner. This belief produced in them a dramatic, exalted self-awareness. Younger brother was totally integrated in their community. He was one of them. He awoke every day into a state of solemn joy. On both of Cole House's attacks, he used automobiles the young men stole for him in Manhattan. The autos were returned without damage to their garages, and if the phenomenon of their disappearance and return was reported to the New York police, it was never connected by them to the events in Westchester. After the bombing of the municipal fire station, when Cole House's picture was published on every front page in the country, he sat down with a sheet over his shoulder and permitted one of the young men to shave his head and his neat mustache. The change in him was striking. His shaven head seemed massive. Younger brother understood that, whatever its practical justification, this was no less than a ritualistic grooming for the final battle. A day or two later, one of the band brought in the daily papers with photographs of the Model T raised from the pond. This tangible proof of the force of Kohlhaas's will made them all feel holy. By the time they received news of Willie Conklin's flight and sat down to discuss the proper response, they were so transformed as to speak of themselves collectively as Kohlhaas. "Kohlhaas gone to that coal and ice yard," one of them said. "Willie be a dead man now. We missed our chance." "No, brother," said another. "He better to us alive. He keeping Kohlhaas in the folks' minds. He a plague. Now we going to do something so terrible bad in this town, no one ever mess with a colored man for fear he belonged to Kohlhaas." Chapter 33. Ah, what a summer it was! Each morning Mother opened the white curtained glass doors of her room and stood looking at the sun as it rose above the sea. Gulls skimmed the breakers and strutted on the beach. The rising sun erased the shadows from the sand as if the particled earth itself shifted and flattened, and by the time she heard Father astir in the adjoining room, the sky was beneficently blue, and the beach was white, and the first sea bathers had appeared down at the surf to test the water with their toes. They breakfasted in the hotel at tables covered with starched white cloths. The service was heavy hotel silver. They dined on half grapefruit and shirred eggs and hot breads, broiled fish, ham slices, sausage, a variety of preserves dispensed to oneself from tiny spoons, coffee and tea, and all the while the breezes from the ocean lifted the bottoms of the window curtains and shivered their salt thrill along the high fluted ceiling. The boy was always eager to be up and out, and after the first few days they allowed him to excuse himself and watch from their table as he appeared moments later running down the wide steps of the porch with his shoes held in his hand. They were on nodding acquaintance with several of the guests. This would yield to speech eventually, and then the mild curiosity aroused by this one's looks or that one's dress would be satisfied. They were in no rush. They felt they looked grand and prosperous. Mother bought beautiful summer ensembles from the boardwalk shops. She wore white and yellow, and in the informality of afternoons abandoned herself to no hat and only carried a sun parasol. Her face was bathed in soft golden light. They would swim in mid-afternoon when the air became still and the heat oppressive. Mother's bathing costume was modest, but she required several days to feel comfortable in it. It was black, of course, with skirt and pantaloons that came below her knees and low-cut swim shoes, but her calves were exposed and her neck almost to the bodice. She insisted that they separate themselves by several hundred yards from the nearest bathers. They encamped under a hotel umbrella with its name imprinted in orange upon its escalloped fringe. The negro woman sat upon a straw chair some yards away. The boy and the brown child studied the tiny crabs that buried themselves with a bubbly trail in the wet sand. Father wore a horizontal striped blue and white sleeveless one-piece bathing suit that made cylinders of his thighs. Mother found it distasteful to see the outlines of his maleness in that costume when he emerged from the water. Father liked to swim out. He lay on his back beyond the breakers, spouting water like a whale. He came in staggering through the waves, laughing, his hair flattened on his head, his beard dripping and his costume clinging to him immodestly, and she felt momentary twinges of dislike, so fleeting she didn't even recognize what they were. After sea bathing, everyone retired for a rest. She would remove her costume with relief, having wet it only for a few moments in the foamy surf, and sponge the salt from her skin. She was so fair that the shore was dangerous for her. Yet cooled by her ablutions, powdered and loosely gowned, she could feel the sun stored in her, spreading in her blood, lighting it as at noon it did the sea, with millions of diamond flashes of light. After the swim was soon established by Father as the time for amour. He would make his lusty, heedless love every day if she allowed it. She silently resented the intrusion, not as in the old days, but with some awareness of her own, some sort of expectation on the skin that was only pounded from her. She thought about Father a good deal. The events since his return from the Arctic, his response to them, had broken her faith in him. The argument he had had with her brother still resounded in her mind. Yet at moments, for whole days at a time, she loved him as before, with a sense of the appropriateness of their marriage, its fixed and unalterable character as something heavenly. Always she had intuited a different future for them, as if the life they led was a kind of preparation, when the manufacturer of flags and fireworks and his wife would lift themselves from their respectable existence and discover a life of genius. She didn't know of what it would consist, she never had, but now she no longer waited for it. During his absence, when she had made certain decisions regarding the business, all its mysterious potency was dissipated, and she saw it for the dreary, unimaginative thing it was. No longer expecting to be beautiful and touched with grace till the end of her days, she was coming to the realization that whereas once, in his courtship, Father might have embodied the infinite possibilities of loving, he had aged and gone dull, made stupid perhaps by his travels and his work, so that more and more he only demonstrated his limits, that he had reached them, and that he would never move beyond them. Yet she was happy to be in Atlantic City. Here Sarah's child was protected. For the first time since Sarah's death, she could think of her without weeping. She enjoyed being viewed in public, as in the dining room at the hotel or on the veranda in the evening, or strolling on the boardwalk down to the pavilions and piers and shops. Sometimes they hired a chair in which she and Father sat side by side and were slowly pushed along by a porter. They made lazy examination of the occupants of chairs going in the opposite direction, or glanced discreetly at other riders they happened to pass. Father tipped his straw. The chairs were wicker with fringed canvas tops that reminded her of the Surreys of her childhood. The two side wheels were large as on a safety bicycle. The small wheel in front swiveled and sometimes squeaked. Her son loved these chairs. They could be hired too without a man, and he loved that best of all, for then he pushed the chair with his mother and father seated in it, and he could direct it as he would, at whatever speed, without their feeling the need of instructing him. The great hotels stood behind the boardwalk, one next to the other, their awnings flapping in the sea wind, their immaculately painted porches lined with rocking chairs and white wicker settees. Nautical flags flew from the cupolas, and at night they were lighted by rows of incandescent bulbs strung along their roof lines. One night the family stopped at a pavilion where a brass band of negroes stoutly played a rag. Mother didn't know which one. That she remembered ringing from her piano at home under the fine hands of Mr. Colehaus Walker. She had for days lived not in forgetfulness of the tragedy, but in relief from it, as if in this resort city by the sea, painful thoughts were blown off by the prevailing breezes as soon as they formed. Now she was almost overcome by the music, which was associated in her mind also with younger brother, and immediately her love for her brother, a wave of passionate admiration broke over her. She felt she had neglected him. An image of his lean, moody, impetuous being flashed in her mind, somewhat reproachful, somewhat disgusted. It was the way he had looked at her over the dining table at home as Father cleaned his pistol. She felt a slight vertigo, and looking into the light of the pavilion, where the indomitable musicians sat in red and blue uniforms with their shiny trumpets and cornets, tubas and saxophones, she thought she saw under each trim military cap the solemn face of Colehaus. After that evening, Mother's joy on the seashore was more tenuous. She had to concentrate on each day as it came. She attempted by sheer resolve to make it serene. She was affectionate to her son, her husband, her invalid father. She was affectionate to her negro woman, and most of all, to the still unchristened and beautiful son of Sarah, who was thriving here and seemed to be growing visibly. She began to consider the attentions that were being paid her by various of the hotel guests. They hovered on the edges of her consciousness, waiting for some recognition from her. For simple occupation, she was now prepared to bestow this. There were several impressive Europeans at the hotel. One was a German military attaché to his embassy, who wore a monocle and always saluted her with discreet gallantry. He was tall and wore that cropped hair they affected, and came to dinner in his formal uniform of white with a black bow tie. He made a great show of ordering wines and then rejecting them. There were no women in his party, but three or four men, somewhat coarser-looking, whose rank was apparently inferior to his. Father said he was a Captain von Papen, and that he was an engineer. They saw him every day walking the beach and unrolling charts and pointing to the sea and speaking to his aides. Usually there was at the time a small craft slowly traversing the horizon. "It is some kind of engineering survey," Father said, lying on the beach sand with his face to the sun. "I can't imagine why the South Jersey coast should interest Germans." Father was oblivious to the man's speculative notice of his wife. Mother was amused by this. She knew from the first careless glance she returned to the officer that he presented to her only the most lascivious intentions, focused, as it were, in the imperiousness of his monocled gaze. She decided to ignore him. There was an elderly French couple with whom she learned to exchange pleasantries. She laughed to recall her schoolgirl French, and they very generously complimented her accent. They never appeared in the sun, except cocooned in endless swathes of linen and gauze topped with Panama hats. For good measure, they carried parasols. The man, who was shorter than his wife and quite heavy, had liver spots on his face. He wore thick glasses. He had enormous pendant earlobes. He carried a butterfly net and jar with a cork stopper, and she a picnic hamper so heavy that she could not walk upright with it. Each morning she struggled after him over the dunes, and they disappeared in the distant haze, where there were no hotels, no boardwalk, only the gulls and sandpipers and the dune grasses, where sat the trembling wings for which he lusted. He was a retired history professor from Lyon. Mother tried to interest grandfather in the French couple on the basis of their academic background. The old man would have none of it. He was totally engrossed by his condition, and too irritable to engage in civilized discourse. He defeated all the diversions she thought up for him except one, a daily ride in a boardwalk chair in which he could sit and be wheeled without being thought infirm. But he carried a cane across his lap, and whenever the pedestrian traffic did not move fast enough for him, he lifted the cane and prodded women and men alike, who would turn and stare outraged as he sailed past them. There were other guests, of course, who were not Europeans. A gigantic stockbroker from New York, with a huge wife and three immense children, who spoke not a word when they dined. Several family groups from Philadelphia who could be placed quickly by the nasalities of their speech. But Mother found that the persons who interested her were invariably foreigners. They were not a substantial number, but seemed to beam more life than her countrymen. The most fascinating of all was a small, limber man who wore jodhpurs and a white silk shirt open at the neck, and a flat white linen cap with a button. He was a flamboyant, excited person whose eyes darted here and there like a child's, afraid of what they might miss. He carried on a chain around his neck a rectangular glass framed in metal, which he often held up to his face as if to compose for a mental photograph what it was that had captured his attention. One cloudy morning, on the hotel porch, it turned out to be Mother. Caught in the act, he came over and in a thick foreign accent made profuse apologies. He was, he said, the Baron Ashkenazi. He was in the moving picture business, and the glass rectangle was a tool of the trade which he could not forbear using even when on vacation. He laughed sheepishly, and Mother was charmed. He had shining black hair, and his hands were delicate and small. She saw him next on the beach, leaping about some distance away, entertaining a child at the edge of the sea, picking up things, running this way and that, and holding up his peculiar rectangular glass. With the sun behind him, he was no more than a silhouette, but she immediately recognized his energetic figure, even at that distance, and she smiled. The Baron Ashkenazi was the first guest to join Mother and Father at their table. He arrived with a beautiful little girl whom he introduced as his daughter. She was astonishingly lovely, about the same age as the boy. Mother had immediate hopes that they would become friends. Of course, they sat there and said nothing and didn't look at one another. But she was a remarkable creature, with the darkest eyes and thick black hair like her father's, and a Mediterranean complexion. She wore a fine white lace dress, with a satin bodice shaped by the smallest suggestion of a bosom. Father could not take his eyes off the girl. Through dinner she said nothing, nor did she smile. But the explanation was soon forthcoming, after the appetizer, in fact, when the Baron, in a lowered voice, his hand going out to touch his daughter's hand, explained that her mother had died some years before, although he did not say what. He had never remarried. A moment later he was again his ebullient self. He talked incessantly in his European accent, with malapropisms he himself recognized and laughed over. Life excited him. He dwelled on his own sensations and liked to talk about them, the taste of the wine or the way the candle flames multiplied in the crystal chandeliers. His simple delight in everything was infectious, and soon Mother and Father wore constant smiles on their faces. They had forgotten themselves. It was enormously pleasurable to see the world as the Baron did, alive to every moment. He held his rectangular glass aloft, framing mother and father, the two children, the waiter walking toward the table, and at the far end of the dining room a pianist and a fiddler, who played for the patrons on a small platform decorated with potted palms. "In the movie films," he said, "we only look at what is there already. Life shines on the shadow screen as from the darkness of one's mind. It is a big business. People want to know what is happening to them. For a few pennies they sit and see their selves in movement, running, racing in motor cars, fighting, and, forgive me, embracing one another. This is most important today in this country, where everybody is so new. There is such a need to understand." The Baron lifted his wine glass. He looked at the wine and tasted it. "You have, of course, seen his first mistake? No? A daughter's innocence? No?" He laughed. "Don't embarrass. They are my first two picture plays. One reelers. I made them for under $500, and each has brought $10,000 in receipt." "Yes," he said, laughing, "it is true." Father had coughed and turned red at the mention of specific sums. Misunderstanding, the Baron insisted on explaining to him how this was a good profit, but not unusual. The film business was at this time booming, and anyone could make money. "Now," the Baron said, "I have become myself a company in partnership with the Pathé Exchange for a story 15 reels long, and each reel will be shown one a week for 15 weeks, and the customer will come back every week to see what next happens." With a mischievous look, he took a shiny coin from his pocket and flipped it into the air. It went nearly as high as the ceiling. Everyone watched it. The Baron caught the coin and flattened his hand on the table with a loud smack. The silver jumped, the water shook in the glasses. He lifted his hand, revealing one of the popular new 5-cent pieces, a buffalo nickel. Father couldn't understand why he was doing this. "How I name myself," the Baron said with delight. "I am the Buffalo Nickel Photoplay Incorporated." As the Baron went on talking, Mother looked across the table at the two children sitting next to each other. The idea of examining through a frame what was ordinarily seen by the eye intrigued her. She composed them by her attention, just as if she had been holding the preposterous frame. Her son's hair was combed back from his forehead for the occasion, and he wore a large white collar with his little man's suit and flowing tie. His blue eyes, flecked with yellow and green, looked up at her. All the beautiful child next to him needed in her white lace and satin dress was a veil. Her eyes were raised now, and she returned Mother's gaze with a directness that verged on defiance. Mother saw them as the bride and groom in a characteristic grade school exercise of the era, the Tom Thumb Wedding. Chapter 34. And so the two families met. The sun spread over the sea each morning, and the children sought one another down the wide corridors of the hotel. When they rushed outside, the sea air struck their lungs and their feet were chilled by the beach sand. Awnings and pennants snapped in the wind. Every morning, Tata worked on the scenario of his 15-chapter photoplay, dictating his ideas to the hotel stenographer and reading the typewritten pages of the previous day's work. When he was alone, he reflected on his audacity. Sometimes he suffered periods of trembling in which he sat alone in his room smoking his cigarettes without a holder, slumped and bent over in defeat, like the old Tata. But his new existence thrilled him. His whole personality had turned outward, and he had become a voluble and energetic man full of the future. He felt he deserved his happiness. He'd constructed it without help. He had produced dozens of movie books for the Franklin Novelty Company. Then he had designed a magic lantern apparatus on which paper strips printed with his silhouettes turned on a wheel. A wooden shuttle passed back and forth in front of an incandescent lamp like a loom. The apparatus was accepted for mail order distribution by Sears Roebuck and Company, and the owners of Franklin Novelty offered to make Tata a partner. In the meantime, he discovered that others were doing animated drawings like his, except for projection on celluloid film. From this he became interested in film itself. The images did not have to be drawn. He sold his interests and went into the movie business. Anyone with enough self-assurance could get backing. The film exchanges in New York were desperate for footage. Film companies were forming overnight, reforming, merging, going to court, attempting to monopolize distribution, taking out patents on technical processes, and in all ways exemplifying the anarchic flash and fireworks of a new industry. There were commonly in America at this time titled European immigrants, mostly impoverished, who had come here years before hoping to marry their titles to the daughters of the nouveau riche. So he invented a baronry for himself. It got him around in the Christian world. Instead of having to erase his thick Yiddish accent, he need only roll it off his tongue with a flourish. He dyed his hair and beard to their original black. He was a new man. He pointed a camera. His child was dressed as beautifully as a princess. He wanted to drive from her memory every tenement stench and filthy immigrant street. He would buy her light and sun and the clean wind of the ocean for the rest of her life. She played on the beach with a well-bred comely boy. She lay between soft white sheets in a room that looked into an endless sky. The two friends every morning went to the deserted stretches of beach where the dunes and grasses blocked the hotel from their sight. They dug tunnels and channels for the seawater, walls and bastions and step dwellings. They made cities and rivers and canals. The sun rose over their bent backs as they scooped the wet sand. At noon they cooled themselves in the surf and raced back to the hotel. In the afternoons they played in sight of the beach umbrellas, collecting sticks of wood and shells, walking slowly with the little brown boy splashing after them in the ebb tide. Later the adults retired to the hotel and left them alone. Slowly, with the first blue shadows reappearing in the sand, they followed the tide lines beyond the dunes and laid down, for their most serious pleasure, a burial game. First, with his arm, he made a hollow for her body in the damp sand. She lay in this on her back. He positioned himself at her feet and slowly covered her with sand, her feet, her legs, her belly, and small breasts and shoulders and arms. He used wet sand and shaped it in exaggerated projections of her form. Her feet were magnified, her knees grew round, her thighs were dunes, and on her chest he constructed large nippled bosoms. As he worked, her dark eyes never left his face. He lifted her head gently and raised a pillow of sand under it. He lowered her head. From her forehead he built lappets of sand that spread out to her shoulders. No sooner was the elaborate sculpture completed than she began to destroy it, moving her fingers gently, wiggling her toes. The encrustation slowly crumbled. She raised one knee and then the other, then burst forth altogether and ran down to the water to wash off the crust of sand on her back and the back of her legs. He followed. They bathed in the sea. They held hands and squatted and let the surf break over them. They went back to the beach, and now it was his turn to be buried. She built the same elaborate casing for his body. She enlarged the feet, the legs, the small prominence in his bathing suit she built up with cuppings of sand. She built out his narrow chest and widened his shoulders and gave him the lappeted headdress he had designed for her. When the work was done, he slowly broke it to pieces, cracking it carefully as a shell and breaking out then for the run to the water. In the evening, sometimes, their parents took them to the amusements on the boardwalk. They would hear the band concert or see the road show. They saw Around the World in 80 days. Clouds floated through the theater. They saw Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But the real excitement was in the attractions the adults would not dream of patronizing, the freak shows, the penny arcades, the tableau vivant. They were too shrewd to express their desires. Then, after a few visits downtown, when the trip seemed not so formidable, they persuaded the adults they were capable of making it themselves. And fortified with 50 cents, they ran along the boardwalk in the dusk. They stood looking into the lights of the mechanical fortune-teller's glass case. They put in a penny. The turbaned figure, its mouth clacking open on shining teeth, turned its head right and left, and raised its hands in a jerking way. A ticket was extruded, and the entire apparatus lurched to a halt in mid-smile. "I am the great he-she," the ticket said. They put money in the claw machine, directing it by means of wheels to drop the steel claw where it would clutch the treasure they wanted and release it into the chute. In this way they received a necklace of shells, a small mirror of polished metal, a tiny cat of glass. They viewed the freaks. They walked quietly among the exhibition stalls of the bearded lady, the Siamese twins, the wild man from Borneo, the Cardiff giant, the alligator man, the 600-pound woman. It was this behemoth who stirred on her stool and quivered as the children came before her. She was seized with an irrepressible emotion and rose on her tiny feet and came toward them mountainously. The great gardens of her flesh closed and opened, going out and in, as she spread her arms in oscillations of sentiment. They moved on. Behind each fence, the watchful, normal eyes of the creatures tracked their odyssey. From the giant, they bought a ring from his finger, which went around their wrists. From the Siamese twins, a signed photo. They ran out. Their desire for each other's company was unflagging. This was noted with amusement by the adults. They were inseparable until bedtime, but uncomplaining when it was announced. They ran off to their separate rooms with not a glance backward. Their sleep was absolute. They sought each other in the morning. He did not think of her as beautiful. She did not think of him as comely. They were extremely sensitive to each other, silhouetted in a diffuse excitement like electricity or a nimbus of light, but their touching was casual and matter-of-fact. What bound them to each other was a fulfilled recognition which they lived and thought within, so that their apprehension of each other could not be so distinct and separated as to include admiration for the other's fairness. Yet they were beautiful, he in a stately blonde thoughtfulness, she a smaller, darker, more lithe being, with flash in her dark eyes and an almost military bearing. When they ran, their hair lay back from their broad foreheads. Her feet were small, her brown hands were small. She left imprints in the sand of a street runner, a climber of dark stairs. Her track was a flight from the terrors of alleys and the terrible crash of ash cans. She had relieved herself in wooden outhouses behind the tenements. The tails of rodents had curled about her ankles. She knew how to sew with a machine and had observed dogs mating, whores taking on customers in hallways, drunks peeing through the wooden spokes of pushcart wheels. He had never gone without a meal. He had never been cold at night. He ran with his mind. He ran toward something. He was unencumbered by fear and did not know there were beings in the world less curious about it than he. He saw through things and noted the colors people produced and was never surprised by a coincidence. A blue and green planet rolled through his eyes. One day, as they played, the sun grew dim and a wind began to blow in from the sea. They felt the coldness on their backs. They stood up and saw flights of heavy black clouds coming over the ocean. They started back to the hotel. The rain began. Raindrops pelted craters in the sand. Rain left streaks on their salted shoulders. It poured into their hair. They took shelter under the boardwalk a half mile from the hotel. They crouched in the cold sand and listened to the rain spatter the boardwalk and watched it collect in droplets between the planks. Debris was under the boardwalk. Broken glass and staring putrefied fish heads, torn parts of crabs, rusted nails, broken boards, driftwood, starfish as hard as stone, oiled spots of sand, bits of rags with dried blood. They stared out at the sea from their cave. A storm had risen, and the sky glowed with a green light. Lightning broke the sky as if it were cracking a shell. The storm punished the ocean, flattened it, cowed it. There were no waves now, but aimless swells that did not break or roll into the beach. The weird light increased in intensity. The sky was yellow. The thunder broke as if the surf were in the sky, and the wind now blew the rain along the beach, whipped it into the sand, rolled it down the boardwalk. Coming through the wind and water and golden light were two figures walking with their heads down, their arms shielding their eyes, and they would turn and with their backs to the wind look up and down the beach and cup their hands to their mouths, but they could not be heard. The children watched them without moving. They were Mother and Tata. On they came. They stumbled through the wet sand. They turned, and the wind blew their clothes against their backs. They turned, and the wind blew their clothes against their chests and legs. They cut away from the water toward the boardwalk. Tata's black hair flattened over his forehead, shone in the bright water. Mother's hair had come undone and lay in wet strands about her face and shoulders. They called. They called. They ran and walked and looked for the children. They were distraught. The children ran into the rain. When Mother saw them, she dropped to her knees. In a moment, the four were together, hugging and admonishing and laughing. Mother laughed and cried at the same time, with the rain pouring down her face. "Where were you?" she said. "Where were you? Didn't you hear us call?" Tata had lifted his daughter to hold her in his arms. "Gott zu danken," said the Baron. "Gott zu danken." They walked back along the beach in this rain and light, happy, huddled all together, soaking wet. Tata could not help but notice how Mother's white dress and underclothes lay against her so that ellipses of flesh pressed through. She looked so young with her hair down on her shoulders and matted around her head. Her skirt stuck to her limbs, and every few moments she would bend to pluck them away from her body, and the wind would blow them back against her. When they had discovered that the children were missing, they had run down to the beach, and she had removed her shoes at the bottom of the boardwalk stairs and held his arm for support. She walked with her arms around the children. He recognized in her wet form the ample woman in the Winslow Homer painting who was being rescued from the sea by Toline. Who would not risk his life for such a woman? But she was pointing to the horizon. A lead of blue sky had opened over the ocean. Suddenly Tata ran ahead of them all and did a somersault. He did a cartwheel. He stood on his hands in the sand and walked upside down. The children laughed. Father slept through the incident. He was unable to sleep at night lately and had begun to nap in the afternoons. He was restless. He had read in the newspaper of the growing movement in the Congress for a national tax on income. This was his first presentiment of the end of summer. He took to making regular telephone calls to his manager at the plant in New Rochelle. Things were quiet at home. Nothing more had been heard from the Black Killer. Business was holding up, as he would know from the copies of the orders sent out to him every day. None of this put him at ease. He was becoming bored by the beach and no longer cared to bathe in the ocean. In the evenings before bed, he went to the game room and practiced billiards. How could they resume their lives if they remained in Atlantic City? Some mornings he awoke and felt that time and events had gone on and left him more vulnerable than ever. He found their new friend, the Baron, a momentary distraction. Mother thought he was endearing, but he felt no special sympathy from him or for him. He wanted to pack up and leave, but was constrained by Mother's security in the place. Here, she believed it might be possible to wait for the coal house tragedy to conclude itself and hope it could be outlasted. He knew this was an illusion. To the consternation of the hotelier, she had taken to having the brown child at her table in the dining room. Father gazed at the little boy with grim propriety. At breakfast the morning after the rainstorm, he opened the newspaper and found on the front page a picture of the father. Coal House's gang had broken into one of the city's most celebrated depositories of art, Pierpont Morgan's Library on 36th Street. They had barricaded themselves inside and commanded the authorities to negotiate with them or risk having the Morgan treasures destroyed. They had thrown a grenade into the street to demonstrate the capacity of their armaments. Father crushed the paper in his hands. An hour later he was paged to the telephone for a call from the district attorney's office in Manhattan. That afternoon, borne by Mother's anxious good wishes, he climbed aboard the train for New York. Chapter 35. Even to someone who had followed the case from its beginning, Coal House's strategy of vengeance must have seemed the final proof of his insanity. By what other standard could the craven and miserable Willie Conklin, a bigot so ordinary as to be like all men, become Pierpont Morgan, the most important individual of his time? With 8 people dead by Coal House's hand, horses destroyed and buildings demolished, with a suburban town still reverberating in its terror, his arrogance knew no bounds. Or is injustice, once suffered, a mirror universe, with laws of logic and principles of reason, the opposite of civilizations? We know from Brother's journal that the actual plan had been to make Morgan a prisoner in his own home. The man's thinking had been that Conklin hiding in an Irish neighborhood was as undetectable as Coal House was in Harlem, and that therefore he had to be flushed out. What was needed was a hostage. 2 nights of discussion had turned up the candidacy of Pierpont Morgan. More than any mayor or governor, he represented in Coal House's mind the power of the white world. For years he had been portrayed in cartoons and caricatures with his cigar and his top hat as the incarnation of power. The great fiefdom of New York could be made to pay an army of fire chiefs and a fleet of Model Ts for the ransom of its Morgan. But Kohlhaas had entrusted the reconnaissance of the Morgan home to two of the youths who knew little about the city below 100th Street and less about the ways of the wealthy. When they reconnoitered the Morgan establishments, the one a brownstone townhouse, the other a palace of white marble stone, they chose the white marble for the residence. Younger brother would have seen the error, but he was the ordnance man. He lay in the back of a covered van loaded with explosives and supplies. He could hear the attack underway. The van was backed up to the library gates, and he was given the signal to unload. When he lifted the canvas flaps and looked out, he screamed that it was the wrong building. But at that point there was no turning back. A guard lay dead, police whistles were heard, the sound of gunfire had alerted the entire neighborhood. The conspirators unloaded the van, bolted the great brass doors, and took up their assigned positions. Then Kohlhaas made a quick inspection of the premises. "Nothing is lost," he assured them. "We wanted the man, and so we have him, since we have his property." As it happened, Pierpont Morgan was not even in New York. He was 2 days to sea on the SS Carmania bound for Rome. He was making a slow pilgrimage to Egypt. Kohlhaas had not known this either, so the entire action, misdirected and poorly timed, seemed to enjoy some special grace. Almost immediately, aides of the J.P. Morgan Company were informed of the situation. They cabled the Carmania to receive the old man's instructions. For some reason, possibly a breakdown of telegraphy equipment aboard the ship, they could not learn if their message had been received. With Morgan not available to tell them what to do, the police did nothing but cordon off the block from 36th to 37th Street, from Madison Avenue to Park Avenue. Traffic was diverted, and mounted city policemen galloped back and forth to keep the crowds behind the lines. The sounds of the city, its traffic, its horns, its life, seemed walled out by the silence of the scene. The thousands who gathered were as quiet as people can be who are thoroughly engrossed. When night came, flood lamps run by portable generators were trained on the edifice. The rumbling of the generators was felt under the feet of the onlookers like the growling of an earthquake. Police were everywhere in their wagons, on foot, on their mounts, but they seemed to be as much spectators as the crowds they held back. The grenade that was thrown, after the shouted warning by younger brother, had ripped up the sidewalk and left an enormous crater in the street in front of the library gates. At the bottom of the crater, a broken water main bubbled like a spa. Windows had been blown out all up and down the block. There was a brownstone across the street, a private residence, that had been particularly hard hit by the blast. Its owners had fled and had given the police department permission to establish its headquarters on the ground floor. The police discovered that they could run up and down the brownstone steps with impunity and move freely along that side of 36th Street if they did not attempt to step over the curb. The house filled with police department officials and other city authorities, and gradually, as the nature of the confrontation became clear, one authority after another ceded his responsibility to one higher, until finally, with lieutenants and precinct captains and inspectors and the police commissioner Rhinelander Waldo all present, the control of the operation fell to the district attorney of New York, Charles S. Whitman. Whitman had gained considerable fame prosecuting a corrupt police lieutenant named Becker and securing for him the death sentence for ordering four thugs, Jip the Blood, Dago Frank, Whitey Lewis, and Lefty Louie, to murder a well-known gambler named Herman Rosenthal. This monumental case had made Whitman a natural candidate for governor of New York. There was even talk of his eventual nomination for the presidency. He had been about to leave New York with his wife for a vacation in Newport at the 40-room summer cottage of Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish. He had recently been introduced to society by Mrs. O.H.P. Belmont. He valued these connections, but could not resist dropping over to 36th Street when the news reached him. He thought it was his duty as president-to-be. He liked to be photographed at the scene of the action. Upon his arrival, everyone immediately deferred to his judgment, including an enemy of his, the choleric mayor, William J. Gaynor. He thought this was a significant acknowledgment of political realities. He looked at his watch and decided he had a few minutes to take care of this matter of the mad coon. Whitman called for the plans of the library from the architectural firm of Charles McKim and Stanford White. After a study of these, he authorized a reconnaissance by a single athletic patrolman who was to gain access to the library roof and look in the dome skylight over the central hall in the east room to determine how many niggers were in there. A patrolman was found and dispatched to the garden that separated the library from the Morgan residence. Whitman and the other officials waited in the improvised headquarters. No sooner had the officer entered the garden than the sky flashed and there was a loud report followed by an agonized scream. Whitman went pale. "They've got the goddamn place mined," he said. An officer came in. From what anyone could tell, the patrolman in the garden was dead, which was his only bit of luck because nobody could have gone in to get him out of there. The police officials were grim. They looked at Whitman. He now knew that the numerical strength of Kohlhaas's band was not crucial intelligence, but he called the press around and announced that they numbered a dozen and perhaps as many as 20 men. Chapter 36. In the hours following, District Attorney Whitman conferred with several advisers. The colonel in command of the New York militia in Manhattan urged a full-scale military action. This so alarmed one of Mr. Morgan's curators, a tall, nervous man with a pince-nez, who held his hands clasped at his chest as if he were a diva at the Metropolitan, that he began to tremble. "Do you know the value of Mr. Morgan's acquisitions? We have 4 Shakespeare folios. We have a Gutenberg Bible on vellum. There are 700 incunabula and a 5-page letter of George Washington's." The colonel waved his finger in the air. "If we don't take care of that son of a bitch, if we don't go in there and cut off his balls, you'll have every nigger in the country at your throat. Then where would you be with your Bibles?" Whitman paced back and forth. A city engineer told him that if they could repair the broken main, they might be able to tunnel in through the library foundations. "How long would that take?" Whitman asked. 2 days, the engineer said. Someone else thought of poison gas. "That might get him," Whitman agreed. "Of course, everyone else on the east side would die, too." He was beginning to feel fretful. The library was built of fitted marble blocks. You couldn't get a knife blade between the stones. The place was wired for dynamite, and a pair of watchful coon eyes looked out of every window. Whitman now had the good sense to ask for ideas from the police officers in the room. An old sergeant with many years on the street, a veteran of Hell's Kitchen in the Tenderloin, said, "The crucial thing, sir, is to get this Kohlhaas worker engaged in conversation. With an armed maniac, talking calms him down. You get him talking and keep him talking, and then you have a wedge into the situation." Whitman, who was not without courage, took a megaphone and stepped into the street and shouted to Kohlhaas that he wanted to speak with him. He waved his straw hat. "If there's a problem," he cried, "we can solve it together." He repeated such sentiments for several minutes. Then, for a moment, the small window adjacent to the front entrance opened. A cylindrical object came flying into the street. Whitman flinched, and the men in the house behind him dropped to the floor. To everyone's astonishment, there was no explosion. Whitman retreated to the brownstone, and only after several minutes did someone using binoculars make the object out as a silver tankard with a lid. An officer ran into the street, picked up the tankard, and sprinted back up the brownstone stairs. The object, now dented, was a medieval drinking stein of silver with a hunting scene in relief. The curator asked to see it and advised that it was from the 17th century and had belonged to Frederick, the Elector of Saxony. "I'm really pleased to hear that," Whitman said. The curator then raised the lid and found inside a piece of paper with a telephone number that he recognized as his own. The district attorney took himself to the telephone. He sat on the edge of a table and held the speaker in his left hand and the receiver attached by a cord in his right. "Hello, Mr. Walker," he said heartily. "This is District Attorney Whitman." He was stunned by the calm, businesslike tone of the black man. "My demands are the same," said the voice on the phone. "I want my car returned in just the condition it was when my way was blocked. You cannot bring back my Sarah, but I want for her life the life of Fire Chief Conklin." "Kohlhaas," Whitman said, "you know that I, as an officer of the court, could never give over to you for sentencing, outside the law, a man who has not had due process. That puts me in an untenable position. What I can promise is to investigate the case and see what statutes apply, if any. But I can't do anything for you until you're out of there." Kohlhaas Walker seemed not to have heard. "I will give you 24 hours," he said, "and then I will blow up this place and everything in it." And he rang off. "Hello," Whitman said. "Hello?" He ordered the operator to get the number again. There was no answer. Whitman next sent off a telegram to Mrs. Stuyvesant Fish in Newport. He hoped she read the newspapers. His eyes, which tended to bulge when he was exercised, were now quite prominent. His face was florid. He removed his jacket and unbuttoned his vest. He asked one of the patrolmen to find him some whiskey. He knew that Red Emma Goldman, the anarchist, was in New York. He ordered her arrested. He stared out the window of the brownstone. The day was overcast and unnaturally dark. The air was close, and a fine rain made the streets glisten. The lights of the city were on. The compact white Grecian palace across the street shone in the rain. It looked very peaceful. At this moment, Whitman came to the realization that the deference shown by Commissioner Rhinelander Waldo and everyone else in the police department had tricked him into identifying himself with the politically dangerous situation. He had on one hand to guard the interests of Morgan, whose various Simon Pure reform committees of wealthy Republican Protestants had funded his investigations of corruption in the Democratic Catholic Police Department. He had on the other hand to preserve his own reputation as a tough DA who dealt handily with the criminal classes. For that, nothing would do but the speediest unhorsing of the colored man. A glass of whiskey was brought to him. "Just this one to calm my nerves," he said to himself. In the meantime, police knocked at the door of Emma Goldman on West 13th Street. Goldman was not surprised. She always kept packed and ready to go a small bag with a change of clothes and a book to read. Ever since the assassination of President McKinley, she had been routinely accused of fomenting by word or deed most of the acts of violence or strikes or riots that occurred in America. There was a national obsession of law enforcement officers to connect her to every case just as a matter of principle, whether they believed she was guilty or not. She put on her hat, picked up her bag, and strode out the door. She rode in the police wagon with a young patrolman. "You won't believe this," she said to him, "but I look forward to a spell in jail. It's the one place where I can get some rest." Goldman did not know, of course, that one of the Coal House band was the young man she had pitied as the bourgeois lover of an infamous whore. In front of the sergeant's desk at police headquarters on Center Street, she made a statement to reporters as she was booked for conspiracy. "I am sorry for the firemen in Westchester. I wish they had not been killed. But the Negro was tormented into action, so I understand, by the cruel death of his fiancée, an innocent young woman. As an anarchist, I applaud his appropriation of the Morgan property. Mr. Morgan has done some appropriating of his own." At this, the reporter shouted questions. "Is he a follower of yours, Emma? Do you know him? Did you have anything to do with this?" Goldman smiled and shook her head. "The oppressor is wealth, my friends. Wealth is the oppressor. Coal House Walker did not need Red Emma to learn that. He needed only to suffer." Within an hour, extra editions of the newspapers were on the streets featuring the news of the arrest. Goldman was liberally quoted. Whitman wondered if it had been wise to give her a forum. But he did derive one clear benefit from the move. The president of Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, Booker T. Washington, was in the city to do some fundraising. He was delivering an address downtown at the Great Hall of Cooper Union on Astor Place, and he departed from his prepared text to deplore Goldman's remarks and condemn the actions of Coal House Walker. A reporter called Whitman to tell him of this. Immediately, the district attorney got in touch with the great educator, asking if he would come to the scene and use his moral authority to resolve the crisis. "I will," Booker T. Washington replied. A police escort was sent downtown, and Washington, apologizing to the hosts of the luncheon in his honor, left to ringing applause. Chapter 37. Booker T. Washington was at this time the most famous Negro in the country. Since the founding of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, he had become the leading exponent of vocational training for colored people. He was against all Negro agitation on questions of political and social equality. He had written a best-selling book about his life, A Struggle Up from Slavery to Self-Realization, and about his ideas which called for the Negro's advancement with the help of his white neighbor. He counseled friendship between the races and spoke of the promise of the future. His views had been endorsed by four presidents and most of the governors of southern states. Andrew Carnegie had given him money for his school, and Harvard had awarded him an honorary degree. He wore a black suit and Homburg. He stood in the middle of 36th Street, a sturdy, handsome man with all the pride of his achievement in the way he held himself, and he called out to Kohlhaas to let him in the library. He disdained the use of the megaphone. He was an orator, and his voice was strong. There was nothing in his manner to indicate any other possibility than that the desperadoes would grant him his demand. "I am coming in now," he called, and he stepped around the crater in the street and walked through the iron gates. He climbed the steps between the stone lionesses and stood in the shadow of the arched portico between the double Ionic columns and waited for the doors to open. There was now a silence and a stillness in the scene that allowed the horn of a cab many blocks away to be heard clearly. After some moments, the doors opened. Booker T. Washington disappeared inside. The doors closed. Across the street, District Attorney Whitman wiped his brow and sank into a chair. What Booker Washington found was the awesome gilded library of paintings and tiers of rare books, statuary and marbled floors, damask silk walls, and priceless Florentine furniture, all wired for demolition. Fascia of dynamite were strapped to the marble pilasters of the entrance hall. Wires led from the east and west rooms along the floor to the rear of the entrance hall, where there was a small alcove. Here sat a man straddling a marble bench. On the bench was a box with a T-shaped plunger, which he held with both hands. His back was to the brass doors, and he was leaning forward, so that if a bullet were to kill him instantly, the weight of his falling body would depress the plunger. This fellow now turned to look over his shoulder at Washington, and the great educator drew in his breath sharply as he saw it was not a Negro, but a white in black face, as if this were some minstrel show. Washington had entered in a stern and admonitory frame of mind, but with the intention to be diplomatic. He disdained persuasion now. He looked in on the west room and then walked across the hall to the doorway of the east room. He had expected to find dozens of colored men, but saw only three or four youths standing each beside a window with a rifle in his hands. Kohlhaas stood waiting upon him in a well-pressed houndstooth suit and tie and collar, although he carried a pistol in his belt. Washington looked him over. His handsome brow furrowed and his eyes flashed. Summoning all his declamatory powers, he spoke as follows. "For my entire life I have worked in patience and hope for a Christian brotherhood. I have had to persuade the white man that he need not fear us or murder us because we wanted only to improve ourselves and peaceably join him in enjoyment of the fruits of American democracy. Every Negro in prison, every shiftless, no-good, gambling and fornicating colored man has been my enemy, and every incident of faulted Negro character has cost me a piece of my life. What will your misguided criminal recklessness cost me? What will it cost my students laboring to learn a trade by which they can earn their livelihood and still white criticism? 1,000 honest, industrious black men cannot undo the harm of one like you. And what is worse, you are a trained musician, as I understand it, one who comes to this infamous enterprise from the Lyceum of Music, where harmony is reverenced and the strains of the harps and the trumpets of heaven are the models for song. Monstrous man! Had you been ignorant of the tragic struggle of our people, I could have pitied you this adventure. But you are a musician. I look about me and smell the sweat of rage, the impecunious rebellion of wild, unthinking youth. What have you taught them? What injustice done to you, what loss you've suffered, can justify the doom you have led them into, these reckless youths? And may you be damned,